Good morning. Welcome along to this morning's webinar around navigating volatile markets. My name is Andrew Tilley. I'm Technical Director at Retirement Advantage. And this morning I'm joined by Tommy Canty, who's Sales Manager at Investec, and Andrew Morris, who's Sales Manager at Canada Life Investments. The webinar should last about an hour today. And if you'd like to ask any questions as we go along, if you click on the chat button and type in your question there, we'll pick some questions up at the end, and we'll definitely come back to you by email any other questions we don't have time to cover. So it's just a very brief introduction before I pass on to Tommy. The retirement market's obviously moved very substantially over the last few years towards drawdown. And obviously customers are taking on a number of risks in drawdown that they wouldn't have taken on as if they bought an annuity. Now, markets have been fairly benign over the last few years, but at some point we are likely to experience a market correction of some form or other. So what we're trying to do this morning is look at if that happens, how we can help clients navigate through any crash or correction. So we've got various different sessions. Tommy's going to look at the causes and characteristics of a bear market. He'll pass on to Andrew, who's looking at reducing risk within a drawdown portfolio. Tommy will come back to look at a multi-asset protector fund, which is a way of protecting downside. And then I'll look at our drawdown solution and how that can help people in volatile markets. So now I'm going to pass on to Tommy, and he will look at the first element.
Good morning, all. Thank you very much for dialing in. So while the old country is upbeat, I've been given the task to bring the mood down a little bit by talking about the causes, characteristics, consequences of bear markets. So over the next 10 to 15 minutes, we're going to have a look at why are we having this conversation now? What is a bear market and what causes them? How do bear markets typically evolve? And with this in mind, how should we invest? As we know, it's the second longest bull market since the 1920s. And this slide illustrates that perfectly. We're looking at the months since trough and the dates of previous trough with the length of the US business cycles on the left-hand side. And as mentioned there, looking at the S&P bull markets over the last 100 years, we're certainly into the tail end. But as we know, bull markets do not die of old age. So what has been the story of this particular bull run? This slide talks through the market emotion cycle, although it could double up the World Cup emotion cycle as well, what's happened over the last month or so. But if we go back to late 2008, early 2009, and if you're looking at the right-hand side, the bottom of the mountain on the right-hand side, we saw periods of panic, capitulation, despondency. Then if you move over, we had borderline depression, but then central bankers and governments took aggressive action and we experienced hope, relief, optimism, and more recently, we've seen signs of excitement, thrill, and worryingly, the first indications of euphoria. Now, why did I say worryingly? Well, Sir John Templeton said bull markets are born on pessimism, grown on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. And we're going to cover off a few of those early flags of euphoria. Firstly, bears or pessimists have at every opportunity since 2009 have called for the collapse of this bull run, whether it's the collapse of China, the Eurozone, the US, the global economy. They've looked to call the end of this. But what's one indication that we are approaching the end of this cycle is the bears have gone into hibernation. Some bears completely reversing their stance and talking about the prospect of melt-ups in equities. A more common sign of euphoria, one that's been used on many times, is a looking at valuations and how expensive developed markets are. This is probably the scariest valuation metric we could find. We're looking at the price to sales ratio of the S&P 500. So basically, one unit of sales made by US companies and looking at where we, what levels we're at the moment. And as you can see, we're at similar levels that we were at the turn of the century when the tech bubble burst. Looking at consumer sentiment, this is looking at the US as and asking the US consumers where they think markets would go at the beginning of the year, what they thought that the view was for the next 12 months, and 70% of consumers were expecting stocks to advance. You put that into comparison to where we were in 2009, less than half of that, so 35% thought that markets would move up over the next 12 months during that period. Not a good sign for a contrarian investor, and again, an early sign of euphoria. But I suppose the biggest flag is waving regarding euphoria and the poster child is people start doing things with their money that arguably they wouldn't do in the past. And cryptocurrencies and anything related to artificial intelligence, automation, all went exponential last year. And when you get a failing company like Kodak, the camera company, issuing the Kodak coin, and the share price bounces 300% in a couple of days, it's a sign that people are doing things they wouldn't normally do, and a sign of euphoria. Then there's the fear of missing out. So this is a picture of Chuck Prince, who loads of don't know him. He's the former chief exec of Citigroup, who famously said in 2007, when the music stops in terms of liquidity, things will be complicated. But as soon as the music is playing, you've got to get up and dance. And as we're still dancing. That worked great for Chuck during 1995 to 2007. However, we all know how that ended. So it's a useful lesson to take note of that when the party is reaching fever pitch and everyone's crowding into the middle of the dance floor, it's usually the time to start edging away and forming an exit plan. Because we know those that in the centre that are partying hardest will end up with the biggest hangovers. Let's bring us in, what is a bear market? Well, a bear market means that we would have a drop of 20% or more to be classed as a bear market. We've seen pauses, we've seen dips, we've seen corrections, but we haven't quite reached that bear market status as it stands at the moment. The main causes of bear markets, prevalence of these characteristics, and not just valuation, as I mentioned earlier. So it was only in 1987 that it was predominantly linked to excess valuations. What normally needs to happen is exit valuations are normally accompanied by other characteristics. Now, 25% of bear markets are down to shocks. So we saw in the 70s down to oil price, that was the oil price shock. 50% is triggered by an economics recession. But the most prolific offenders is the cost of capital, with either a strong rise in the cost of capital or interest rates having a 66% change of chance of triggering bear markets. And if we see a significant rise in cost of capital, we can almost expect a bear market based on history. The major sponsor of this second longest bull run in history have been central bankers. And it's their experimentation with what they've done. As I mentioned at the outset, that quantitative easing, and now we're seeing quantitative tightening. And you can see from the red line being bonds and equities, cumulative return through this period, and what central bankers have been doing throughout this period. So printing money, increasing amount of pounds, whether it's dollars, euros or yen, has forced the price of financial assets higher. But in terms of money printing, central bankers have printed close to $20 trillion. And to put that into context, the US economy is $19 trillion in size alone. And it's pushed these price of equities and bonds higher, which is shown in the red line. But what I want to point out is what the blue line's done when central bankers have stopped printing. So you can see in 2011 and 2014, when they've stopped printing and the blue lines move sideways, the markets have become a little bit more bumpy. Look where we are today, another move sideways, And what we do expect in coming years, this blue line is actually projected to turn down when the Fed shrink their balance sheet and the European Central Bank and Bank of Japan stop printing. At the same time, the cost of capital has been emerging from its slumber. This chart shows cash rates versus US core inflation rates. Cash rates are now in excess of inflation rates for the first time since 2008. We know in this period where cash rates have been near zero, investors sought to generate real returns and moved up the risk spectrum to generate the income they want, whether from short-dated government bonds, investment grade, high yield, emerging market, or indeed equity for income. As this dynamic continues to play out, this process should happen in reverse and investors move back down the risk spectrum into cash. This is now reversing from the previous tailwind into an headwind. So there are a few of the red flags that we think it's time to be a little bit more cautious and expect that we could see a correction on the cards, not necessarily within the next 12 months, but is it now the time to be a little bit more cautious when looking at your investments? How deep are bear markets and how long do they last? It won't come to any surprise that no bear markets have been the same. And this is illustrated on the table on the right-hand side, where if you look at 1987, where we saw a 33% decline in just 16 weeks, compare that to 1929, where we saw the same decline, but then a further 50% for a length of time of 145 weeks. On average, over the last 100 years, 41% decline has taken, on average, the bear market's been a 41% decline and has taken nearly 2 years from trough back to peak. We've not got a crystal ball, and to use one last sporting analogy, we feel that in cricket terms, we're 7 or 8 wickets down and the tail is wagging. How long that tail will wag, we don't know. What we can do is look at how we structurally diversify across different asset classes and be prepared for strategies that actively allocate capital to both enhance and protect returns. Focus on security selection because broad market exposure may be less rewarded. If you are worried about what we've discussed, just look at strategies that are defensive and explicitly focused on downside protection. So to summarize our thoughts on that, we're not calling for an imminent bear market, but we would say that the investment is all about judging whether we're being compensated sufficiently for the risk that we're taking. Valuations are elevated and there's some signs of euphoria. No immediate recession imminent, but the probability is rising and the cost of capital is rising along with central banks removing the liquidity punch bowl. As a result, the potential reward relative to the risk of being heavily exposed to equity markets doesn't really stack up. I'll now pass you over to Andrew Morris from Canada Life, who will talk about reducing risk within a drawdown portfolio.
Excellent, thank you very much, Tommy. Good morning, everyone. So as what Tommy was saying, I'll be looking over the next 10 to 15 minutes about reducing risk within a drawdown portfolio and how a more sort of cautious fund approach could potentially benefit those clients looking to take income during drawdown. Now, sort of kicking straight off into it, before we've done this presentation, we wanted to have a look at historically how the different multi-asset areas sort of performed over the last 30 years. So we looked at the North 35 sector, the 20 to 60 and the 45 to 80, with the idea of what would have happened if you put in 100,000 investments at 4% income, with the idea of answering three basic questions. Over the last 30 years, which one was most likely to return above your initial investment? Which one was most likely to combat inflation? And finally, which one was most likely to return at the highest level of income? Now, look at the first one, the most likely to return above your initial investment. Well, what was sort of surprising was that if you'd invested in any point in the last 30 years, it would have been the high risk side, which would have given you your largest return. And it's by quite a large margin. I mean, you're probably thinking any point in the last 30 years, there was a 97% chance if you'd invested in the high risk sector, you would have returned above what you put in while taking a 4% income. When you included inflation of roughly 2%, once again, it was the higher risk side, still in excess of over 70% chance of outperforming. And then finally, most likely return you the highest level of income over the entire period. Well, once again, it was your higher risk side. Now, if you're all suddenly thinking, hang on, you've just said it's probably best sort of looking at a cautious approach, but your research has shown that the higher risk side is done, why do I not just put all of my money into the higher risk side? But when you sort of look at this research, what we're really doing is looking at start to finish. I mean, if I was to sort of plot the returns of the 40 to 85 sector, what it does is, in research terms, exactly what you want it to do. It starts low and it ends high. However, when you are taking a regular income at drawdown, it's actually the journey which can be considered the most important and not just the end. If you have a look at the annual returns of the 40 to 85 sector, you can see it's anything but stable. And when you've seen crashes and crises and bubbles come through, it drops down quite significantly. Now, what does that mean specifically for those looking to take an income? Well, if I give you an example, I said, okay, Mrs. Miggins, she sold a pie shop, she's got £100,000, and she decides to put it in to the 40 to 85 sector. And from that, she's taking 4% income per year. Now, over the course of the next 30 years, her income will look something like that. And that is the change of income from the previous year. So for the first 10 years, she's done pretty well. Her income every single year has gone up, which means that she can go on the extra holidays, she can give money to the kids and the grandkids, everything's happy. But the moment there is a crash, a crisis, or a bubble, I mean, if you look at the early 2000s with the tech bubble, in the first year alone, she lost over £1,000 of her income. The following year after that, she lost a further £1,200, and then another £700 the year after that. So in the space of 3 years, she lost £3,000 of income, initially from her 4% pot. Now, it's still 4% each and every year. But as everyone knows, as your income grows, so does your expenditure, and it can have a detrimental effect. Now, when you look at the overall returns of her income over those 30 years, it does what you expect it to do. It starts low, ends high, but it's a very choppy ride. And for some clients, that's not what they're looking for. In comparison, the 0 to 35 sector, you can see it's a lot smoother. So that the returns are a lot easier. You're not going to get the highest amount or a lot larger than a higher risk sector, but it is a lot more smoother. And it's not just it being the 0 to 35 sector. Realistically, you're looking for a lower volatility. Now, to give you one sort of final example as how volatility can affect, if we said, okay, Mrs. Miggins, she goes back in time, and this time she goes, I'm going to put half of my money into a low volatility fund, and I'm going to put the other half into a high volatility fund, which just so happens to be twice the level of volatility. Now, over the next 30 years, her low vol fund ends up returning her 10% per year, every year, for 30 years. Her high vol fund also returns her 10% per year, every year, for 30 years. So on paper, they've done exactly the same. However, because she's taken an income every single month, her low vol fund, her drawdown pot will end up looking something like this, just because she's taking out less than what she's earning. Now, you would then sort of look to assume that the high vol will do the same because of the level of returns. However, because she's taking every single month, volatility has a negative effect over time. And her end drawdown pot size looks something like this. Now, it is it is an extreme case, having double the level of volatility for it. But this just goes to show that volatility in drawdown is not necessarily your friend. Now, if we look back at this and get, okay, that was start to finish. If we look specifically now, not just overall in the last 30 years, but during times of uncertain markets, and more explicitly within every crash, crisis, or bubble that's experienced in the last 30 years. And if you are unlucky enough to be the guy that invested clients only in those points in time. And instead of looking at those first initial questions, we sort of look back and said, okay, instead of getting the highest level of returns, which one was most likely to return you a better average over time? Now, remember, these are all the falling markets over the last 30 years. But when you look back, if you were unlucky enough to invest in only those periods, it was a low risk side, which ended up giving you the best average return. Now, again, sort of put it into figures. If you'd invested 100,000 at 4% income, the average return in your 35 sector would have been about 97,000. You only would have lost about 3,000 from that pot size. In comparison, your high risk would have returned you about 88,000 and your UK equity income side with about 80,000. Once you take into account inflation as well, once again, it was a low risk side. And finally, and some clients, this may be the most prominent for them. Which one is most likely to return you 4% of your initial investment continuously? Now, the reason I say this, because most clients, when they sort of go into retirement, they're not savvy. That's why they go for a financial advisor to be able to tell them everything and be able to do the journey for them. But when they hear I've got £100,000 and you're telling me 4% income, in my head, that's £4,000 a year. Those years where they get £8,000, no questions. The moment they're getting £3,000, £2,000, it's going to be 4% of the pot. The pot's lower. So when we look at all those periods in the last 30 years, which one was most likely to return you your 4% of your initial? Once again, it was your lower risk side. And again, every worst point in time, it would return to you about 3.97% in comparison to your higher risk, 3.3 annual UK equity income side of roughly 3.1. So sort of diving in as to sort of where Canada Life Investment sort of fits in with all this, and our focus on risk for steady returns. Now, for those of you that have looked into Retirement Advantage recently, you would have seen that a lot of the Canada Life Investment funds have now been included on there. One of them being the TRA Canada Life North 35 Fund. Now, this one was sort of introduced back in the early 2000s. I mean, Canada Life as a whole, we've always been a sort of company for steady growth, steady returns, and to really sort of match the liabilities we've had. And we wanted to sort of replicate that within the fund. So in the early 2000s, we released the North 35 Fund. And its main focus within that fund is to dampen down volatility and fluctuations with an overall sort of low volatility. We want it to be an all-in-one solution that's fully diversified, and finally look to aim to deliver steady growth and income. And that's the main focus. We will invest mainly internally or within the same managers that run our funds, with the idea being a nice steady growth and income without taking excessive levels of risk. Now, our current focus that we're looking at, given market conditions, are interest rate risk, currency or exchange rate risk, and finally, your market risk, your market correlation risk. Now, I'll run through those three and what we're currently doing there in a bit more detail now. Now, when we start off with interest rate risk, what we're currently focusing on within the fund is monitoring the duration of the underlying funds. Now, the sort of rule of thumb with duration and interest rate rises is that if an interest rate rise was to go by 1%, its corresponding bond will rise or fall by 1% in the opposite direction for every year of duration. So if you think if the interest rate rose by 1%, a fund with a duration of 20 years would likely fall roughly 20% in value, whereas those with a one-year duration would roughly fall around 1% in value. So currently right now, we've got focus on duration of the underlying funds with the idea of adjusting between your shorter and longer term funds given market conditions. The end result is that it will lower overall interest rate risk within the fund. Now, to give you an example of this, towards the end of 2016, Trump came into power and it was all about let's rise interest rates, let them go higher and higher. And you saw that the sector, the corporate bond sector, dropped close to 5% very, very quickly. Now, it did end up picking itself back up, and then more news came out and it dropped. It went back up, more news came out, dropped, and it's sort of been doing the same process again and again. Now, in comparison, short duration in the same time frame, it sort of looked like this, and it's been a lot lower on the downside. You don't get the same level of upside, but it's a smoother ride. Now, anyone can argue that, well, we'll just hold short duration and absolutely nothing else, or we can just hold 50-50 and be in there. And whereas holding the short duration alone, it doesn't get you any of the upside, just holding a flat 50-50, you're still getting the same sort of levels of fluctuations within there. Now, being able to monitor this on a regular basis and being able to adjust between one and the other, we're hoping to get a nice smoother line going through. Next one being your currency or your exchange rate risk. Now, what I'm about to say, it's probably been against what you hear every other fund manager talk about over the last 10 to 15 years. And that is, we only invest in sterling denominated assets. If the underlying isn't in sterling, the fund doesn't buy it. Now, anyone could then argue that, well, you're not getting the maximum growth you can do. If you want growth, you go globally. The UK only accounts for, what, 2% global growth overall. We've not been top 20 performer in the last 1, 3, 5, or 10 year period. And that's completely true. But this fund isn't looking to try and get you the highest level of growth. It's looking to give you a steady return. And by only investing in sterling denominated assets, This fund completely removes any direct foreign currency exchange rate risk. So whereas you're not going to get the highest level of return, you're going to hopefully get a smoother return within there. Now, we do look to try and gain global growth in a different way. If I was to show you this, this is the UK 250 underlying company sales. And you can see half have come from the UK, the other half globally. So that's relatively diversified. You have a look at the top 100 companies in the UK, and you can see realistically less than a quarter of sales comes from the UK, with the bulk coming globally. So being able to pick underlying underlying stocks which have a global presence, get global growth, but higher quality based in sterling, you're getting none of the foreign currency exchange risks, but hopefully a bit of the growth on top. The end result, you can see the blue line here is the actual Canlife 35 fund. It's been a nice steady performing fund throughout. I wanted to give you an example, the red line being if you bought it in US dollars, just to show you how different it can be. Now, that could have obviously been on the other side, but what stays consistent is the level of volatility. Again, the red line being if you'd invested in a foreign currency, the blue being the fund itself, only buying sterling, and you can see the volatility is a lot lower and more consistent. Finally, your market risk. We want to make sure this is a diversified portfolio, and we will diversify to dampen down volatility. We won't go out and buy every single sector that there possibly is, just because we want to make sure what we're buying actually helps to diversify and lower that volatility. So alongside with your equities, bond and cash, we also hold just shy of 20% in direct physical property. The fund won't buy a REIT, just so they end up looking more like equity funds, but direct physical property. So you get a good diversification within there. We will review the asset allocation at least on a quarterly basis at a minimum. And once that's been set in, we will always look to review the underlying every single day and rebalance daily if needed to keep it in line. Now, most advisors that run their own sort of model portfolios have probably asked themselves at one point or another, how often is too often when it comes to rebalancing? And most people sort of turn around, there is no sort of fixed moment in time. Some do it monthly, others quarterly, annually for some. So doing it on a daily basis, is it actually worth the while? Well, because we're buying internal funds, first and foremost, there is no double charging. We do a lot of rebalancing through inflows and outflows. And what it's sort of proven is that when you have a look at performance, by rebalancing every single day with the whole idea of pound cost averaging, it does give you incrementally better returns. But more importantly, it also lowers overall volatility. The end result of all this currently is the Canlife Managed Nought 35 Fund. It is a diversified portfolio which has exhibited low volatility. It's delivering reasonably steady growth and income over a cycle, and it's low cost while still being fully active. Now, cost-wise itself, if you were to go buy this on any platform or supermarket at the moment, you'd be able to pick it up for an AMC of 45 pips and an OCF of 78 pips. But for a fully active fund, it's very well priced. For anyone looking to use it in a drawdown and buy directly within Retirement Advantage, you'll be able to pick this up for 31 pips. That's an extremely low price, again, while still getting fully active management. Because we do understand that in times of sort of stale markets and falling markets, the costs do make a big difference. So now you can realistically buy a fund for 31 bips. If you were to invest, say, 250,000, 300,000 within the retirement account, you have a product fee of 20 bips. You can then add half a percent for an advisor fee, which means the client's paying all out just over 1% for a fully active fund. A very flexible product and full advisor charging. As you can see here, the standard deviation of the fund or volatility has been a lot lower than its sectors, which is what we're looking for. Performance has been very, very good over time. Now, I would always like to sort of put it out there that I've never been a fan of these types of performance figures. Your 1 year, 3 year, 5 year. Your discrete helps show consistency over time, but again, it's only ever a sort of fixed moment. I mean, to give you an idea, this is pretty much saying that if you've invested on the 28th of the second, 2013, for the 5 year performance, you would have got 29.47%, 10% more than the sector. Doesn't tell you what would have happened the month before or the month after. It's only just a steady fixed point in time. Now, the reason I say this, we like to be a bit different in Canada Life Investments. So alongside these performance figures, every month, we also release our multi-period relative return success chart, which is a big mouthful and it looks very, very full. But if you ignore it all for a second, this is really here to give you, the advisor, a bit of confidence that you can give the client confidence in the fund and its consistency to outperform. So if, again, if you forget everything there, if you just look towards the hit ratio percent and start following the red box, all this is saying is that if you'd invested in any month in the last 10 years, so whether that be exactly 10 years ago, whether that be 8 years, 3 months ago, 6 years, 11 months ago, 3 years, 2 months ago, any month in the last 10 years, and you held on to the fund for 3 years, there was a 92% chance you would have outperformed the sector by an average of 4.7%. So basically, if you had 120 clients, and every month for the last 10 years, you were investing them into the North 35 funds, you'd have 92% of your client base outperforming the sector by an average of 4.7%. It's consistency. It gets rid of those performances where someone has one or two really great years and then eight mediocre years, or for the shorter term period has a couple of great months and 10 mediocre months. This is to show that every single month when you are taking a regular income, you're getting the consistent outperformance. Now again, this is available every single month. You're able to grab a copy, just speak with your account manager or local BDM for the area. Now that's pretty much it for me. There are a lot of sort of learning outcomes that sort of ran through there. You will be able to grab copies for this either on the side or get emailed to you towards the end. But if you do decide, actually, let's forget everything Andrew said over the last 10 to 15 minutes. If there's only one thing I'd ask you to remember, is that the Canada Life Management 35 Fund has been created specifically to deliver steady returns and income over a market cycle, which is just perfect for anyone looking to take an income during drawdown. Now that's it from me. I will now pass you back to Tommy, who will look to run through the Multi-Asset Protector Fund. Over to you, Tommy.
Thank you. Hello again. I'm just going to spend the next 10 minutes introducing or reintroducing the Multi-Asset Protector Fund. And for those that you are looking for a new home for MetLife money, or were worried about the how many cases you're writing to the at the proof fund, we think we've got the a credible alternative or complement that could go with that comfy pair of slippers, which is the proof. And this strategy was launched in 2009, when maybe you didn't need a protected fund in your portfolios. But as I've discussed earlier, we feel this is the perfect storm for a daily traded growth fund that locks in protection along the way. I'm not going to dwell on these learning outcomes. We'll cover this over the next 10 minutes. And for those that do want more information on this fund, I do have a Match of the Day highlights email with frequently asked questions that can be used with your end client, and also a viewpoint pretty much covering off that bear market presentation at the beginning. So we're going to have a quick look at the fund, the positioning, and then the overview. So what do we try to achieve with this fund? We're looking at attractive long-term returns. And since 2009, we've averaged 6.5% per annum, but we have had a good tailwind. We're aiming for an excess of 5% per annum returns, but importantly, with downside protection. So to protect at least 80% of the fund's highest NAV. That's the important bit, that 80% of the fund's highest NAV, and we'll go into that in a little bit more detail. This is a global and unconstrained fund. We can go anywhere in the universe, not restrained by geography or assets. And importantly, it doesn't stick to a benchmark. We're just looking to achieve those outcomes. I'm not going to dwell on attractive long-term returns because it's the standard slide from any fund group. The rule is you show two lines with your line coming out on top of it. But what we have done is stuck to that remit of excess returns above 5%. What I want to draw your attention to is the blue box, which dated 19th of June and 2018 with MAP 2 plastered on that. Now, you'll notice that this slide only goes back to July 2012. Because this is the launch of, that was when the launch, we launched MAP 2, which is the unbundled RDR version of the fund. As I say, back to that box, we're looking to be as transparent as possible. So every day you can see what the bid price is, the protected price, and the effective level of protection is for the fund. How do we do that? Well, we use a global unconstrained approach to multi-asset investing, and we look at asset class behavior rather than labels. When I first started talking about a multi-asset funds back 20 years ago, it was pretty much UK equities, UK bonds and cash. But now you know that a high yield bond will behave like an equity in drag. So it's important to look at the asset class behavior rather than labels. By being completely unconstrained, it means that we can offer the first line of protection by, if we are optimistic, by all means, allocate to our growth assets. But if we are more pessimistic, it's important that we'll be able to protect your clients' money by going heavily into the defensive assets. It's an high conviction, actively managed fund. This is probably the most important slide of this session, explaining how that protection works. So, as I mentioned, the price goes up. You can see you've got the blue line with the price, the green line being the protected price, and the orange line with the current floor. Launched at a pound, as the price moves up, the protection floor price moves up. Importantly, as the price falls down, the protection floor remains at 80% to the fund's highest ever price. This is probably illustrated better if you look at in between just March 2015, where we had that drawdown period at 11.4% and up until September 2016, until the fund reached a new high. So as the price moves up, the protection floor moves up. As the price moves down, the protection floor remains at 80% to the fund's highest ever price. How do we do that? And why are we different? There will be a number of you that have been stung by protected funds in the past, and I'm happy to answer any questions of that at the end of the session. But what we do is we focus on the return engine rather than the downside management. There's been a number of protected strategies that put disproportionate emphasis on that complex drawdown management, while the underlying portfolio return engine can be relatively basic. Our view is spend more time on the return engine and it's less needed, you won't need the downside management as much. With the positioning of the funds, we can access our ideas a number of ways, directly into equities, or bonds via zero share classes internally. So the best ideas of Investec. If we want access to UK equities, we have two great funds internally that are, there's no double charging. We could also use ETFs, which offer great liquidity, and it gives us access to markets that we may not have the expertise in. Or there's a small amount externally, again, where we're not being big-headed, thinking that we can be all things to all men, and we have, and be able to answer everything internally at Investec. That approach, all to keep costs down, and more importantly, enables us to move from defensive to growth, or growth to defensive very quickly. Always taking a forward active view when constructing our portfolios, knowing exactly what's under the bonnet. As you can see, portfolio construction at the moment is pretty much a 50-50 split between growth and defensive. We've evolved and refined this daily traded transparent OEIC fund. We've got a skilled driver in an investment team boasting 33 investment specialists, looking at structural diversification to capture returns and protect capital. The braking system, we do have that cash portfolio that systematically increases as markets fall from peak. However, we've put greater focus on the return engine, meaning that we're relying less on that downside management cash portfolio. As it stands at the moment, the 20% cash is discretionary cash held within the growth engine, with nothing in the cash portfolio in that downside management. If we do have that Armageddon scenario, the airbag, if you like, is a protection contract that we have with Deutsche Bank. So should we have that Armageddon scenario where markets fall, or a global equity markets fall 40% overnight, say, and the fund, the first two seatbelts don't work, and the fund falls through that greater than 20% from its peak NAV, Deutsche Bank will come in and cover the difference. To bring that into an outlook summary for the fund, we've already discussed that we're relatively late cycle. Economic growth remains constructive and will likely be supported by US fiscal stimulus. Recession risk remains low over the next 12 months, all of which remains supportive for corporate earnings. Countering this, and as discussed earlier, central banks are progressively removing the punch bowl, which has supported markets for many years. So turning it into a headwind now rather than a tailwind. We feel this is the perfect storm for a protected strategy. It's not just a protected strategy, it's a growth fund with protection that's going to lock that in on a daily basis. Making it an ideal solution pre and at retirement. Unlimited growth, but not at the expense of protection. Daily traded, transparent, tax efficient, available in all the wrappers, and at a very competitive price of 1.03% OCF. It's a DT rated 4, and the aim of actually achieving 5% per annum return means that we can get your clients' money 100% protected within 5 years. What we've done historically is done that in 3 years. I'll now pass you over to Andrew to field any questions.
Good morning again, everyone. So we've heard quite a lot about investment so far this morning. So what I wanted to do was just look at the retirement market and progress back into what it means to clients who are in drawdown. In particular, I'll look at the solution available from Retirement Advantage and how it might be able to help your clients as they move through volatile markets as and when they appear. So we've obviously seen a huge change, as I mentioned at the beginning, a huge change to the retirement market. So if we go back before Pension Freedom, vast numbers of customers, more than 90% of them bought an annuity. What we've seen over the last few years is now the majority, two-thirds of people now move into drawdown. And we've had fairly benign investment conditions, so that's been a relatively smooth journey for many of these people. Nonetheless, these customers in drawdown will face a number of key risks. So obviously investment risk that they're now taking on as they move through retirement, but not just pure investment risk, but as they're taking an income, which many of them will be doing as they get older, they're taking on a sequence of returns risk. So it's not just about the investment returns they achieve, but the order in which they achieve these investment returns. We hear a lot about income sustainability at the moment, about how much people can withdraw in a safe manner. I'm not a fan of talking about a safe withdrawal rate. I think it does need reviewed on an ongoing basis and taking into account customers' individual circumstances. And people obviously can underestimate, and many do underestimate, their longevity. A key aspect of drawdown is managing tax. So it's all about taking tax efficient withdrawals, so having a flexible contract to allow you to do that, but also to manage any exposure to your lifetime allowance and pass on money tax efficiently on death. And that's obviously a huge driver for why many people use drawdown in the first place, around passing on, cascading that wealth down to family. And then we've also got a whole bunch of things that can come in from left field and weren't necessarily planned, whether that's death of a partner, divorced, and we'll obviously see continual change from the regulatory perspective. So drawdown is hugely flexible and it allows people to manage their money flexibly and efficiently as they move through retirement. But there are a whole range of risks which they take on, which means flexibility is great, but we need to manage that flexibility on an ongoing basis. So what our drawdown contract seeks to allow you to do is help clients manage and those risks as they move through retirement in a flexible way. So as you would expect with any drawdown situation, you can hold money uncrystallized and gradually phase tax-free cash, so you can gradually move money into drawdown. There's a drawdown pot which looks like anyone else's drawdown pot, so you can invest money, take income, take lump sums. The difference in our drawdown is there's also a guaranteed annuity which sits inside the drawdown wrapper, and that's a unique situation. And that guaranteed annuity looks like an annuity that you would normally expect, but it is much more flexible, so it's a much more a new world annuity because it sits inside the drawdown wrapper. And we'll look at how you might want to use that for your clients as you move, as we look through the next few slides. So it's obviously important to mention that while there is an annuity sitting inside the drawdown wrapper, you don't need to use it. You certainly don't need to use it at outset. So this can purely be a drawdown solution. So you can invest money purely in the drawdown. You can phase into that drawdown and take tax-free cash. And obviously at younger ages, that might well be the way that many clients want to do. But as they get older, perhaps, or for more risk-averse clients, they might want to put some money into the annuity to drive a guaranteed income. So perhaps an income to make those essential expenditure and have a pot of money invested in drawdown as well. And then potentially you could move through it into later life, potentially all into a full annuity situation. So the key, I guess, annuities have been poorly used over the last few years, and much of that is because they lack flexibility. So people don't like them because there's a lack of flexibility and perceived poorly death benefits. But by having the annuity sitting inside the drawdown wrapper, that alleviates some of these key issues. So an annuity, if someone does invest in the annuity within the drawdown wrapper, it produces an income, which is what an annuity does. But that annuity stays inside the drawdown wrapper unless the client wants to withdraw it. So a client can decide to take all of that income, and as they take it out of the wrapper, that's when they would pay tax on it. Or they can reinvest that income back into the drawdown. And at that point, it's purely an investment return of the drawdown. No income tax is paid until the client takes it out at a later date. And they can move that income up and down, switch it on and off as often as they wish to do to meet their changing needs as they go through retirement. And what that also allows you to do is to gradually de-risk your client as they get older. So as they're younger, 55, they might just be wanting to take tax-free cash only. As they move into the 60s, they might want to take an element of income from drawdown. Perhaps as they move into the 70s, that's when they might want to switch on a bit of guaranteed income at that point in time. And annuity rates are perceived as poor, and in historic terms, they are poor. But if we look at a guaranteed annuity rate for a 75-year-old, for example, it's about 6.5%. So at that age, it might be of more value to someone locking in a bit of guaranteed income at that older age and getting a good return and adding on good death benefits which can be passed on to family. So that death benefits is obviously a key angle, and it's a key area of why people are choosing drawdown, is this ability to cascade wealth down into the family. And because this is a drawdown situation, that tax-efficient cascading of wealth works entirely. So obviously any pension savings money or any untouched money or any drawdown money, as you would expect, will cascade down into a successor drawdown account. But equally, any annuity death benefits, whether that's a money back option, whether that's a guarantee of up to 30 years, that money will also pass down into a successor drawdown account. And then you can help the beneficiary deal with that in a tax efficient way. So do they want to take it out all at once? Do they want to take it out gradually over a number of tax years? Do they want to leave it invested and cascade it on down to family in the future? So you can work with that beneficiary to make sure that the value of the annuity as well as the value of the drawdown pot is tax efficiently cascaded down to family. So fund proposition, I'm not going to linger on. We've had quite a bit of about investments already today. There's a whole range within the wrap-up of active funds, including some of the Canada Life funds that Andrew mentioned earlier, including the Nottingham 5 fund. We've got a range of passive funds, and we've also got a range of risk-targeted Canada Life funds as well. In addition, we've got protected funds, including the multi-asset protector funds. So there's a range of funds with different risk appetites to suit different clients. So the last bit I just wanted to touch on was who is using this in our product and what we're kind of using it for, which how advisors are using it with the clients. And a lot of that is de-risking drawdown. So drawdown's been around for many years. People might have been in drawdown for quite a lengthy period of time, but now beginning to switch on income and using a combination of drawdown and annuity can help gradually de-risk that portfolio. And as they get older and as their health deteriorates, the income that they can generate from the annuity can be particularly beneficial. Some people might want to guarantee essential expenditure, so that's very much FCA language at the moment is looking at guaranteeing essential expenditure for clients and having money in drawdown over and above that to generate returns. And final salary transfer is also a very topical area at the moment. And many customers would like perhaps to transfer to final salary schemes. Now, I'm not suggesting all should. Most people should probably remain within a final salary environment, but for some people, a transfer may be appropriate. For those people who do want to transfer, in most situations, we're going from the certainty of final salary to the uncertainty of drawdown. So what this our retirement account can offer is a middle aspect, and perhaps the easiest way to demonstrate that is just by looking at a very quick case study. So I guess it was a client that came to us earlier this year. So is someone who was in a final salary scheme who had a deferred final salary benefit. He was divorced with a couple of children and very keen to make sure that his children benefited should he die. So obviously in this situation, the advisor and the client looked at the benefits that he could have got from the final salary scheme should he remain there, which was a tax-free cash sum of around 96,000 and a pension of about 16,000 with the normal add-on benefits of spouse's benefit and benefit increased in line with inflation to some degree moving forward. What the advisor decided to do in this situation was move into our retirement account. One immediate benefit of that is the tax-free cash is greater, and obviously that doesn't all need to be taken at once. That can be phased into if should the client and the advisor wish. In this situation, because the client was relatively risk averse, what the advisor decided to do was put enough money into the annuity element to match the starting income provided by the final salary scheme, with a few key differences. One was we stripped out the spouse's benefit and they put in a 30-year guarantee instead, and that meant should the client die, money would be passed on to his family. So there's full value going back in that situation. And a 30-year guarantee means about 140% of the value initially invested is guaranteed to go back to family. And there was no escalation on that benefit. So that's a key difference, is that money was, annuity income was on a level basis. But what that did give is the flexibility to move that income up and down to meet the client's circumstances. And that left about £118,000, which was invested in drawdown, which the customer could decide to take or leave and cascade to family or take out as lump sum. So it was giving this combination of certainty to some degree, but also flexibility, because it had some flexibility over income. We also had more tax-free cash and a decent sized drawdown pot as well. So for those of you who are involved in the final salary transfers, this might be an interesting option to consider. So as we're very keen to work with you and consider how this solution might fit, help your clients. So we'll have a range of tools and modelling, both for aimed at to help you as advisors, but also perhaps to help clients. So if you wish to use any of these tools or work with us, then please contact your local business development manager, and we're very keen to work with you to help. So hopefully that's quickly covered how our retirement account works. So a drawdown solution, but with an annuity inside that wrapper as well. So hopefully helping customers manage downside risk should they wish to do so. So that's us largely for this morning. So I guess to wrap up, and I think we've got a few questions which we might touch upon, CPD certificates will be sent to you all shortly. The webinar will be available on the Canada Life website should you wish to watch it again, or obviously refer anyone else towards it. I think we've got a few questions, and we're just going to touch off a couple of them in the few minutes we'll have remaining. The first one for Tommy is, how do Investec rate the financial security of Deutsche Bank? So perhaps you'd like to touch
on that. Yeah, certainly. It's a frequently asked question. When we decided to enter that contract with Deutsche Bank, there was a number of other firms out there, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and in our own Investec Bank offered to offer us that protection contract. We went with Deutsche Bank, being a national German bank. And to answer your question of financial security, a few years back, there was a lot of questions regarding Deutsche coming up. The actual contract is up for renewal next year. We are still happy with the it's priced and their financial security. However, if there was a scenario that Deutsche were in trouble, it would be, to go back to that car analogy, we would drive the portfolio a lot more carefully, go more defensive until we found another a counterparty to provide that protection contract.
Excellent, thanks, Tommy. There was one question for me, which was around money purchase annual allowance if people reinvest annuity income. So just to clarify on that, so if someone immediately reinvests annuity income, so never take any income out of the drawdown account, so take tax-free cash, again, the full annual allowance is available at that point in time. But as soon as a customer takes any taxable income from the contract, in the same way as from any other drawdown contract, then the money purchase annual allowance would kick in at that point in time. And so one last question for Tommy, which is a regularly asked question, I think, which is just talking about how this MAP fund, how it differs to other protected funds that people might have seen in the past.
Certainly. I think one of the questions that Bob touched on that as well was regarding the protection element works. I wonder if we could just flip onto a slide that I've got in the pack. We've evolved that to what was the chances of becoming cash locked. We saw in one of the performance slides, we saw a drawdown of 11%. So if you bear with me, see if we can actually find the slide to cover this up. If you can imagine that we have 11% drawdown, what would that mean for what would be in the return engine and what would be in the cash portfolio? Well, in the return engine, if I just flip through that, in the return engine, you would have 35 for 11% drawdown, you'd have about 35% invested in the portfolio, with 65% in cash. Now, that's dangerous levels. Although it's a good inception point to invest because you'll be greater than 80% protected, it's a dangerous levels and something that we were uncomfortable about. That's why we've taken the view of taking more control, focusing on that return engine and having discretionary cash within that portfolio, meaning there's less cash in the algorithm and being dictated to with how much it's got to be into that. Moving that on, what would have to happen to global equity markets if we was to hit that 11% drawdown period again? As I say, you'd have 65% in cash. What would have to happen to global equities alone? And you can see from this slide here, the global equities alone would have to fall 40% overnight. So the chances of it becoming cash locked are very unlikely, we feel. And that need for, I suppose that follows on for the Deutsche Bank question, the needed for that counterparty protection contract is a nice airbag to have, but we don't think it's necessarily needed. And just to put this scenario, if global equity markets did fall 40% overnight, knowing that you're invested in a fund that has protected you to 20% of the fund's highest ever price, you could take your take the money out of that and invest at the bottom of the market. Thanks.
Great, thanks, Tommy. So that brings us to the end of our webinar this morning. Thanks so much for your time and dialing into it. We'll send you CPD certificates to you. But for now, thanks so much for your time.